Aloha, it's Tuesday, April 28th. This is Robbie Dingman in for Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. A spike in immigration lawsuits has led judges in Hawaii to shoulder the burden. And on Maui, Lahaina fire victims fight to get their fair share of a $4 billion compensation settlement. We find out from a Honolulu Parks official how the Konalo storms affected Ho'omaluhia Botanical Garden, how many weeks until all of the park expects to reopen, and how you can help shape a master plan for the popular garden. One of our very own gets tested for leptospirosis after the heavy flooding that inundated the islands. She shares her experience with us. And, do you like jazz? We celebrate International Jazz Day and hear from a local legend about his life gigging in Hawaii. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Robbie Dingman. A surge in immigration lawsuits has overloaded federal courts around the country, and judges in Hawaii have entered the fray. At least five Hawaii judges have taken on cases from California, as some districts are facing thousands of active habeas corpus petitions. Those petitions are filed on behalf of immigrants held in federal detention facilities who say they're being detained unlawfully. Troy Nunley is the chief judge of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of California. Nunley spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the strain that these immigration cases have placed on his district and what led him to ask for help across the Pacific.
Starting with something that you said earlier this month, you took the step of declaring a judicial emergency in your district. Tell me more about why you chose to do that.
Well, let me back up a bit. We actually are already a judicial emergency here in Sacramento, and that's essentially due to the fact that our population far outstrips our number of judges, and we haven't been given new judgeships for quite some time now, and so we are a judicial emergency already. So the situation is essentially exacerbated by the influx of immigration cases. We've seen immigration cases in the past. And quite frankly, I'll tell you, I've been on the bench. I got appointed. I took my commission back in 2013. And between 2013 and when the immigration cases first start hitting here in our district, I probably saw three immigration cases. And so the influx of cases really sort of contributed to what was already an emergency. It made it a sort of, I don't know how you go beyond a super emergency. It made it even more of an emergency, given the fact that we've already been declared a judicial emergency. And that's been declared by the Administrative Office of Courts, the Judicial Council, because of the number of judges. We're just short judgeships. So yes, we are an emergency in any event, and it's even more so because of the number of influx of immigration cases.
I think I read this morning from a SACB story that in the last year, the Eastern District has received more petitions from immigration detainees than almost any other jurisdiction in the U.S., more than 2,700 since January, compared to just 18 in 2024. It's a marked increase. And how's that being felt by you and your clerks and the other judges in your district?
How's it being felt? We work. There's only one way we know how to do things here in the Eastern District. And I don't mean to be trite about it, nor am I trying to sensationalize things. When I first came to the court, I had upwards of 1,200 cases. That was my caseload. And the national average at that time was about 300 cases. So we know one way. We work. And when the influx of cases first hit, we just worked. And we worked for quite a while before we sought any aid. We just worked. And then over time, you know, it was a very short period of time, albeit it was taking its toll on all of our judges. It was taking, and not only the judges, it takes a toll on our staff, because after we read the case, we do the research, we write the orders, we have to send these to our docketing unit. And we were getting these cases at all hours of the night. We were getting them at midnight. We were getting them, and we just didn't know in terms of what should our response be. And so our response was, we're going to immediately do these cases. We get them at midnight, we do them at midnight. We try to get them docketed in the morning. We were getting cases docketed at night. So it impacted all our functions, all our court functions, our core court functions in terms of cases and moving caseloads. But remember, we still have to do our cases. I have a criminal calendar every week. I still had to do that. I got civil cases that I have to do. I got a number of cases that are, you know, fairly big cases that I have to pay attention to. And we don't shirk that responsibility. We still have to do that. It just gave us more to do. Absolutely.
Well, let me ask this question head on. How did it happen that federal judges in the District of Hawaii are hearing cases in your district?
They're very good judges. They're very nice judges. Really, that's all I can say. You got a fine bench. There's not a judge on your bench that I don't like. I really like all the judges on your bench, and they're fantastic. So what we did is we reached out to the circuit, and the circuit sent notices to judges and let them know that we were in sore need of judges to help with the immigration cases. And so we got judges, the judges from Hawaii in particular, Judge Micah Smith, he stepped up and agreed to help us. And, you know, they were seeing, I imagine you were seeing some immigration cases, but not to this level. We also reached out to several other judges. We reached out to the Northern District. They provided us with judges who are currently training in how to handle these cases, because remember, a lot of judges have never seen them before. We also got a judge, Elizabeth, from the Eastern District of Washington as well. And so we were able to get a number of judges to help us out with the cases. So yes, that's how it worked, that we were able to bring judges from outside the district here. Well, they're not coming into the district because they're able to do them from their court, but that's how we ended up getting those judges. So yes.
Do you have a sense of why some of these judges would have volunteered for what essentially amounts to extra work and really high stakes extra work?
You know, I think that it's a community, you know, of judges. You know, we have a fantastic bench, and I don't say that lightly. And I mean the entire bench, the district judges throughout the United States. You know, I go to conferences with other judges throughout the United States, and I've had a number. I just got back from DC. I was at a chief's meeting in Washington, and other chiefs were coming up, and they, you know, they're hard pressed. They still have jobs to do and they got cases to move. But I'll tell you, there's not a judge who didn't come up and express, you know, they commiserated with us and told us. And so I think that's where it's from, you know, just judges wanting to help. And we've always been a court. Remember, even before the immigration cases, we had to use judges to help us out, for example, in our Fresno courthouse, because we don't have enough judges to serve the number of people we have already. And so I think other judges know our plight prior to immigration. And I think when the immigration cases hit, those judges who agreed to help, they knew who we were. So
I did reach out to ICE and DHS for comment on the story I've been working on. And they said in part, quote, significant judicial overreach around the country has caused the number of orders ICE is receiving to reach unprecedented levels. They also said, quote, it should come as no surprise that more habeas petitions are being filed by illegal aliens, especially after many activist judges have attempted to thwart President Trump from fulfilling the American people's mandate. I'm just wondering if you have a response to either of those claims. And I can be more specific, too. I wonder if you consider yourself a quote-unquote activist judge.
I can't comment on that.
All right.
And I won't respond to that. That would be improper. But okay. What I will say is this. Judges throughout the country, at the district court level, at the appellate court level, at the Supreme Court level, we don't do cases in a vacuum. We do cases because we have litigants who come before the court, and litigants feel that they've been aggrieved. They feel that some right has been violated, or they're trying to vindicate some right. It could be a case involving parties where we have diversity jurisdiction when one party is alleging another party did something, or someone may feel like they're being oppressed in some way or some form or fashion. The only thing we do is decide cases. That's what we do. We don't get involved in decisions that are made by the executive branch. We really don't. I don't get involved in decisions. I don't respond to decisions that are made by Congress, members of Congress, by the executive branch. All we do is simply follow a law. And that's what judges throughout the country do. They follow a law. You will never hear a judge comment or criticize the executive branch. You won't hear a judge criticize Congress. You won't hear him criticize ICE or any of the law enforcement agencies. I imagine they have a job to do, and we have a job to do, and we stand ready to do that job. And that's all we're doing is the job that is put in front of us. We have to address the concerns of the litigants who come before us. That's it.
Understood.
Nothing more, nothing less.
Is there anything else that you want to add? Particularly, I mean, listeners here in Hawaii, I imagine this is the first time that they're hearing about judges who sit here who have been taking on specifically immigration cases from California. So anything you would want listeners in Hawaii to know?
No, I mean, I really appreciate the fact that judges from Hawaii are reaching out to help us. I'll tell you this, we have a fabulous bench here. I mean, it's a pretty dire picture with six judges. We do have magistrate judges here. We probably have the largest percentage of magistrate judges, to district judges in the nation. We probably have about 2.5 to 3 magistrate judges for every judge. And so the detention of immigrants, the increase in detention of immigrants here in this district, we've processed, as you know, we've processed a lot of cases. And that's really put a major strain on our court. And what happens, we have to put other matters on hold in order to preside over the influx of cases. And that just dovetails, it's really a tsunami here, for want of a better term, because we're already a distressed district. We're already, you know, working really hard and trying to get our cases in on time and not run afoul of the Civil Justice Reform Act. And we're really trying to do what we can. And this really hinders how we're able to meet that particular mandate. So we really appreciate judges in Hawaii, judges in the Northern District over in the San Francisco Bay Area. We really appreciate judges from Washington, state of Washington, any and all judges who come to help. And remember, we already receive help from a number of judges prior to the immigration cases hitting, but I really appreciate the help. And I tell people, the only thing I say is that, you know, when you're talking about a habeas petition, you're talking about someone who claims they're being held unlawfully. And let's face it, I think we can all agree that, you know, freedom is very important to most folks. And so these are cases that we have to pay attention to. And not in all cases, people are going free. You know, that's not the case. It's not true in all cases. So we have a job to do. I know the executive branch has a job to do and Congress has a job to do. And so we're just essentially doing our job, and that's it.
Thank you so much for your time today, Judge Nunley. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you and good luck. And I really appreciate you reaching out. Take care. Take care.
That was California Federal District Chief Judge Troy Nunley and HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have more to this story on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin June 1st, olliuhm.org.
Tune in to HPR 2 on Sunday at 3 p.m. as the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra continues its celebration of the symphonies of Ludwig von Beethoven. In this concert, we'll hear Symphony No. 2 and Symphony No. 7. We'll also hear Climb, an original work by Jessica Hunt. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR 2, your home for classical music, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. The Mary Jane Girls perform this Saturday in two sets with songs produced by Rick James, such as In My House and All Night Long. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Honolulu Civil Beat's Stuart Yurton joins us now to talk about an eye-opening story published today titled Maui Fire Lawsuit Payouts Are Near, Few Survivors Will Break Even. Stuart, mahalo for taking time today to tell us more about this important story. Can you start with a quick refresher on how this $4 billion settlement was designed to provide critical and speedy help to the victims of the catastrophic Maui fires in August of 2023?
Yes. Thanks for having me, Robbie. So, yeah, so there was a settlement. At the time, soon after the fires, the Hawaiian Electric was really on the verge of bankruptcy, facing all of these potential claims. The parties got together. The state, Kamehameha Schools, was one of the major defendants, and Hawaiian Electric, and they got together and said, okay, let's just come up with a settlement, $4.03 billion, and it would prevent a really lengthy procedure where Hawaiian Electric goes bankrupt and everybody has to file claims against the bankrupt entity. So that was the idea. Let's get it done. Let's get it done quickly. Start getting money to people. Now, after all this time, we're kind of at the beginning of the end, and people could start getting paid in four tranches, four chunks over several years, as early as this summer.
So you say in your story that the first payment could come as early as June.
That's what we understand.
And I think when we were all thinking and hearing about this settlement, I have to just go to, wait, a billion of the 4 billion will go to the lawyers? I don't think that's how we were imagining this would go when we talked about it earlier. How is that coming together?
Well, the lawyers have asked for that, and they say, in general, you'd have a 25% contingency fee if they win, and they've won, and that's what they would get. So it could be, if they got what they wanted, as little as $3.03 billion for the victims. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Judge Peter Cahill, the circuit court judge on Maui, has said, I don't really like this idea. He has an idea to set up what they call a common benefit fund. All the lawyers would pay into that, and the lawyers who did the most work would receive money from that, and the lawyers who were really just kind of hangers-on coming on at the end after the settlement had been negotiated and done would essentially be taxed on that. But nobody really knows what Judge Cahill has in mind yet. It's still unclear. He does seem to be inclined to set up this common benefit fund, but again, how that's going to work out is just not clear, and what it's going to mean for this overall $1 billion in fees number isn't clear either, but he really does seem to want to put a lid on that and lower it somehow.
Yeah, the idea had been that the payments would help to bring people back. They would be able to rebuild and return to their homes. That's how it was envisioned. And Judge Cahill had some kind of spicy moments about what this is rolling out to look like instead. Can you explain a little bit more about the impact he can have?
Yes. Well, the judge can cut back on the fees. That would definitely have an impact, and the money would go to the victims instead of their lawyers. He pointed out how the settlement was done in record time, and that was great. But he said, look, people still haven't gotten a penny yet from that. He had some choice words for people who got previously, as part of a One Ho'ohana fund that was supposed to compensate people quickly, some of the lawyers were asking for 25% fees for that. So he really is trying to make sure as much of the money as possible can go to the victims.
And how will you continue to track this? And are you having an idea of how that will divide up?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There is a format. There's a laid out as part of the claims administration page where they have 10 categories of people and the victims, and some victims might fall into more than one category. So depending on which category they fall into, they could get a certain amount of money based on various factors that will help determine this. But here's the really chilling part. Okay, there are individual claims. There have been something like 94,000 individual claims. 94,816, the latest number I've heard, to be exact. If you get $3 billion, let's say the lawyers got the $1 billion in fees, when you divide the $3.03 billion by the 94,000 claims, you end up with each claim,
yeah.
And again, each person could have different numbers of claims, but each claim is worth about $30,000.
Got it. Okay,
so
Stuart.
There's not enough money to go around.
We appreciate you doing the math for us, and we appreciate the story, and we'll follow up with you another time. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Robbie.
We've been talking with Honolulu Civil Beat business reporter Stuart Yurton. Find this story online at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, serving the Hawaii Island community since 1916, supporting Kupuna Wellness in its TV show Seniors Living in Paradise. KTASuperstores.com.
Ho'umaluhia Botanical Garden in Kaneohe draws more visitors each year than any of Honolulu's gardens, a whopping 730,000 in a year. But the garden made news in March when the Kona Lo storm sent torrents of water through the lush landscape. Parts of the garden remain closed while cleanup mode continues. We talk with Honolulu's Director of Botanical Gardens, Jocelyn Sand, about a new master plan emerging from the Department of Parks and Recreation. First, we ask her to recount the fascinating backstory of how the garden came together.
It's a very timely question, actually, because, you know, we've been going through these Kona Lo storms, and it was similar storm events in the late 60s and the 70s that drove the inception of building the dam that is at Ho'umaluhia. It started as a flood control project, and the Army, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers designed and built it. And so it was a partnership as a flood control project and a DPR garden as well. So when we went through the Kona Lows, that dam is built at such an amazing capacity, you know, in contrast to before the dam, where there was major flooding similar to what we just saw all in that neighborhood that is Kai of the garden. And there were several deaths and there was much property destruction. And it's been open since 1982 and more popular than ever.
Can you describe the impact of the storm at Ho'umaluhia?
Yes, like so many properties, the storm did have a dramatic impact on our lakeshore, our popular lakeshore at Ho'umaluhia. The reservoir there, the lake, has several streams that feed into it. And the stream just below the pedestrian fishing bridge pushed an incredible amount of soil, sediment, rocks, plant debris into the lake. And also onto this large grassy peninsula where many of our visitors gather to enjoy the lake and the wildlife there, and then also go fishing. In places, that sediment is 8 feet deep. So it also just completely degraded this pedestrian path that leads from our education center down to that fishing bridge, kind of leaving this really unsafe, uneven surface. The dam itself is maintained by the Department of Facilities Maintenance, and we'll be working with them to come up with a plan to remove all that sediment from that peninsula area at the lakeside.
And then what are the next steps for the lake and the garden, and any thoughts of reopening that area?
I thank the public for their patience with this. That's such a popular footprint area, and we already have so much capacity issues. And so having to block that off is only making it worse. Great news here, though. Our DPR, our Department of Parks and Recreation folks who help with the maintenance and do all our contracting, they have worked so quickly. And I'm happy to announce that we're already repaving that extensive path from the education center to the fishing bridge. And so it probably is going to take maybe 2 to 3 weeks about for us to restore that path. And then at that point, we should be able to reopen that what we call day use area that leads down to the lake, and we should be able to continue with fishing again as well. So if you could just be patient, maybe for about another 3-4 weeks. Right now we have a lot of heavy equipment down there. It's not safe to have people down there, and we need to just work fast and get this done.
Oh, that's great. That's great news. So by mid-May, potentially.
Yeah, weather permitting, maybe even earlier.
So over the last decade, the number of park visitors, as you know, has more than tripled. What are the challenges of being the most popular botanical garden?
Yes, well, it's the envy of botanical gardens across the nation to have this kind of visitorship. So we're about 730,000 estimated visitors at Ho'omalohia right now. But it is a challenge. We have extremely limited staff. We also have very limited parking, and that road is, if you've been to the garden, it's really narrow, and it's not conducive to this kind of shared mix of pedestrians and cyclists and all that enormous amount of cars, volume of cars now. If it were designed today, I'm sure it would look different. So that's sort of why I think we're going to be talking about this long-range plan later. We're hoping to see what we can do to address some of those challenges.
How many staff members do you have? I know you have some staff and some volunteers.
Yeah, that ties back to the challenge question. Ho'omalohia has the same number of staff that we had when we opened in 1982. We have 9 full-time staff members. There's 7 full-time personnel on the maintenance side and 2 full-time staff on the program side. We also have some part-time staff. We have 4 part-time park attendants and a varying number of part-time program aides, usually about 8 to 12. They work about 19 hours a week. We do have volunteers, you know, who help in the nursery and the garden grounds. They assist with classes and tours and in the education center area. But it's for a 400-acre garden, 730,000 people coming through annually, existing on the same amount of staff that you had, you know, in 82 is becoming increasingly difficult. Yeah.
You've already had one master plan meeting back in November, and Wednesday night, you've got the next one. What are you hoping for?
We do. We have our next one this Wednesday at Windward Community College from 6 to 8:30 at Hale Akoakoa. And you know, so the first one was in November, and that one we started with a blank slate, and we really wanted to just hear from the community and hear from the public about what they like, what they don't like, their dreams for the place, their concerns. We were just gathering input, and that was back in November. Now, we took all that input, and along with staff expertise about the plant collections and the archaeology and the recreational uses, we, you know, looked at the public concerns and our concerns, and we developed some concepts. And so we're ready to present those concepts here this Wednesday to the public. Nothing is final, nothing is, you know, set in stone, but we do have some ideas and some concepts for people to react to. You know, the goals for the whole plan is to just enhance the visitor experience, make it a safer, more inviting place, you know, improve it for the community, provide accessibility, and we want to preserve the environment and the cultural and historical resources there. And we want to provide, you know, some improvements to the botanical side of things and the facilities that is right sizing to the goals and the mission of the garden. So that's kind of what we're looking at. And we really hope people can come out this Wednesday at Windward Community from 6 to 8:30 to join us.
What kinds of things broadly would you be talking about as far as people talked about charging admission to visitors?
Yeah. First and foremost, the most common question we do get is about charging admission. And that is absolutely on the table. But again, we want to emphasize that we wouldn't be charging residents, not for the daily admission. It's something that we're going to be doing with non-residents, similar to how we've done with Hanama Bay. We really do understand that this is a place that is for the residents, that you guys already support it. It costs a lot to live in Hawaii. And these are the places that make us want to stay home and make us enjoy where we live. And our idea is to preserve that for our keiki, for into the future. So that's not where we're going to be looking at getting revenue. However, you know, there is, you know, a basis there for charging for the use. These things cost money. You know, these facilities are getting old. You know, we need to have more people. So revenue is a very important part of the picture. but it will not be, in this administration, it's not going to be levied against residents.
Do you have any feel for how many of the people visiting are residents?
Yeah, it's skewing more tourists now since the spike. It's around 60% tourists, 40% residents. It used to be more 50-50. Again, our admission, our calculations are, you know, estimates. We don't have a ticketing booth or anything that can kind of give us hard data. So when people are not at the gate, you know, data isn't coming in. But right now it is higher on the tourism end than residents. It's outpacing it.
Okay. I was looking you up a little bit about your background. Can you explain how long you've been involved with Honolulu's parks and botanical gardens?
Yeah, I've been director 8 years, but I've been in this system since 1990. I was an early adopter. I came here right after my bachelor's degree, which was from University of Illinois. And I was supposed to be here for 12 weeks for an internship with the National Tropical Botanical Garden in Kauai. And that 12-week visit became my whole life. And I've lived in Kaneohe most of that time. It has been such a journey and such an incredible life to have given to this garden. And being able to finish doing the long-range plan has been amazing. And I'm planning to retire in the end of the year. So this is it's kind of my last little thing I'm doing. Since I started as a plant propagator at Ho'omolohia, that was my first job to come out with this project being, you know, the major thing I'm working on this year has been fantastic for me. It's been a joy.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Director of Botanical Gardens, Jocelyn Sand, about the plan for Ho'omolohia Botanical Garden in Kaneohe. The city invites anyone interested in the garden to attend a second community workshop tomorrow, Wednesday, April 29th at Windward Community College to help chart that future. Maui Nui senior reporter Catherine Kluett-Pachtel joins us now to talk about leptospirosis, a bacterial disease that can affect humans and animals that turns up in Hawaii fairly regularly when people swim or wade in contaminated freshwater. Catherine, thanks for taking time to share, and please explain how unusual this story is for you.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was kind of a bizarre experience. So what started all of this was, you know, like so many folks in our community after the floods, I was helping out a community member to shovel about a foot of mud from their driveway with some other volunteers and wound up getting really sick a couple of days later. But this whole story experience was kind of bizarre for me because, you know, as journalists, as reporters, we're used to kind of separating ourselves from the material, the stories that we're working on. And this kind of had a weird crossover for me. As I went through this experience of getting sick and getting tested for leptospirosis after this, learning a lot and not really knowing a lot going into it, but getting some really surprising information as I was going through this process myself. And, you know, I really just hope that it might help somebody else who might be experiencing something similar or have leptospirosis symptoms to kind of understand the process a little bit more. So what happened with me, you know, again, was volunteering, got sick a couple days later. I had, you know, body chills and fever and body aches. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, I'll hydrate, I'll sleep it off. Sure. And it got really worse. And, you know, lepto had been kind of on the radar, you know, since the flooding, we've been hearing a lot about it. And so, you know, a couple days later, I thought, gee, you know, maybe I should really go to the ER and just get tested for it just in case. You know, didn't think that was what it was. But I had no idea what to expect. And it turns out it's not like a flu or a COVID test where you get the results like an hour later. You may not get leptospirosis test results for like weeks. And so so going to the ER, the doctor, you know, I tested negative for flu and COVID and all the things. And, you know, normally, I guess doctors, because the test results take so long, they just go ahead and treat if they think it is leptospirosis. doctor didn't really think it was in my case, even though some of the things lined up. And so, long story short, you know, I tested, finally got my test results like last week, and it was negative. But leptospirosis bacteria can live for weeks or even months in these wet or damp conditions. And so the risk is still there, you know, after the flooding. You know, we're having like a couple of feet of mud in a lot of places. It gets kind of dry and dusty on the top, but underneath it can still stay wet for a while. And so the Department of Health, you know, advises people to continue being careful. And my biggest question on all of this was, you know, why does it take so long to get these test results? So I spoke with Dr. Nathan Tan, who is the deputy state epidemiologist at the Department of Health, and got some answers. Here's what he told me.
No testing in medicine is perfect, and the testing available for leptospirosis has a couple of issues related to it. One is that it has some limitations in sensitivity, and so not every leptospirosis infection will be detected through available testing. The other issue is that leptospira bacteria are slow growers, and so culturing leptospira in a bacterial culture can take up to 6 weeks, and so for final results to be returned, it can take a while. Testing is performed here locally in the state of Hawaii. The state laboratory divisions does not need to be sent off island. So we're one of the few states that has that testing capacity. We are blessed to have it locally available. Some of the issues can be related to timing of when the testing is performed. So those antibodies that can be formed in response to the infection may not be present early on, and so a repeat test after a couple of weeks to see if there is a rise of antibodies later on can help improve the ability to confirm leptospirosis infections.
So you were definitely right to get the test, and you might have to have a follow-up test, or the negative test you have stops you from where you are. You don't have to do that again.
You know, I think because I'm feeling fine now, you know, my symptoms lasted about a week, and, you know, I feel fine. So because my symptoms aren't continuing, you know, I don't think I'm going to go back for a second test, but it is interesting that a negative test doesn't always mean, you know, systematically that you didn't have leptospirosis. But the biggest takeaway from my conversation with Dr. Tan and other doctors who are dealing with this in the community is if you have symptoms or you suspect leptospirosis, you know, if you've been in areas with flooding, to check early with your doctor, because many lepto cases are mild, but some do become really serious and it can even cause death in a small number of cases. And so Dr. Tan stressed that early treatment is really important if your doctor thinks that, you know, that you may have leptospirosis. Round of antibiotics, you know, that's the standard treatment.
So in your case, it was fortunate that he didn't actually give you a round of antibiotics just to be on the safe side, that you, because of you were described your symptoms and your general health, that helped for you being able to wait until you got the results.
Yeah. So based on my sort of regular blood test lab results that they took when I was at the ER, there were no red flags in that. And I guess there's some sort of blood markers that might indicate leptospirosis, but it is a lot of educated guesswork for doctors, you know, maybe some other tests to rule out infection, other types of infections. And so, yeah, I ended up, you know, we talked about it and I ended up saying, well, you know, let's hold off on the antibiotics since he didn't think that there was a really strong case for leptospirosis. But you can't get lepto from somebody else. It doesn't spread between people. And so what can you do to avoid exposure, you know, avoid getting it? Dr. Tan explains here.
We do know that leptospirosis infections can increase after flooding events. And so we've been communicating with the provider community to be alert for the possibility of leptospirosis, and if it's suspected, to treat early as well as testing as well. Leptospirosis in Hawaii, you know, it is endemic in the animal population. And so it is not uncommon each year that we have cases of leptospirosis. Prior to the pandemic, for example, in 2019, there were 33 cases of leptospirosis. Last year, there were 17. So we know it's a continuing risk, but it is a preventable risk. So I would say for those who have been impacted by the recent storms and flooding, it's important to, when possible, avoid contact with floodwater, mud, and damp materials. keep cuts covered and to keep out contaminated water and wear protective clothing. And then again, to seek medical care early if symptoms develop. Early treatment is really important.
Again, mahalo to HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel for sharing her personal experience dealing with leptospirosis following flood recovery. Read her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
It's International Jazz Day on Thursday, April 30th. So it's no wonder that Ohana Jazz, an event put on by Noel Okimoto and the folks at the Hawaii Musicians Union, is also on April 30th. It invites the public to enjoy a night of jazz and music students to take the stage with professional jazz cats. Okimoto's known this game for a long time, starting his professional jazz drumming career at the ripe young age of 11. He spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about his life playing jazz music, and Okimoto starts us off with how it all began.
Well, what happened was my dad was laid up for having back surgery, and I signed up for a talent show end of my fifth grade year at Kapalama School. I don't know why. And I was already kind of messing around with the drums, you know, unbeknownst to my dad. And then I signed up, and they said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I guess I'll play the drums, you know. So I ended up playing with two records. One was a Young Rascals record, you know, a band that I really liked. And then one was a record that my dad was playing on with Otosan. And that happened to be a bossa nova. So it was a beat I heard him practicing and then learned it. When he wasn't at home, I'd jump on the drums and just kind of emulate it. And then so when my dad, after the surgery, he was laid up for the summer. And when he got home, he had heard that I used his drums. My older brothers had to take me to school and drop me off. And I didn't even know how to set them up. And they weren't that happy to have to take their kid brother to school. But anyway, the first thing he asked me was, I heard you took my drums to school and played. What did you play? And so we went to the room and I sat down and played a bossa nova for him. And he said, how did you learn that? And I said, just by listening to you practice. So he asked me right there, he said, you want to learn how to play the drums? And I thought, summer's starting, you know, my dad's home the whole summer, convalescing from his surgery. And this was perfect opportunity. So I said, yeah, sure, why not, you know. It was a tough decision, boy. I mean, a rough decision. It was difficult. He wasn't very patient, and
I
cried almost every day.
You were in for a tough training.
But I also figured out that, in spite of all of that, you know, if it's not something you really want to do, it's easy to say, "Oh, I don't want to do this anymore. Just quit."
Yeah.
You know, but I knew I wanted to do it, so. Enduring my dad's impatience and whatever, yelling at me, and it was worth it. So at the end of summer, he started gigging again with a band that played on weekends for parties. They're a very busy group called the Ebb Tides. And so he started taking me along at first because he said, you need to help me carry my drums, you know, because he had back.
You're the roadie.
Yeah, I was a roadie. And then when the leader found out that I was learning to play, he said, oh, let Noel sit in. And so I'd sit in on a couple of tunes, you know. Then about 2 months later, my dad left that group to form his own group to do the same kind of work with his friends. And the leader of the Ebb Tides hired me to replace my dad.
So, wow.
So that's how it started.
You, yeah. To be someone still in grade school and to be in a party band must have been a unique experience.
Very, very unique. In fact, some of my experiences were, I mean, it was appalling to some people.
So you've spent, my gosh, how long have you been playing music for professionally?
Okay, well, I guess I started at age 10 or 11, and I'm 67 now, and that's all I've done my entire life.
So in over 50 years, how have you, I guess, seen the genre of jazz kind of mature and evolve over those five decades?
Yeah, there's been a lot of change, I would say. Probably the change that affects everyone the most is the business side of it, you know, how music is consumed, how all of that has dramatically changed, right? I mean, when I started, my dad had a reel-to-reel tape deck that that he had some live recordings. And then cassettes came out. I remember that. I remember my dad getting me my first Walkman, which was a portable cassette. And then they came out with Walkmans that could record music. So it's just the technology, the way people listen to music, consume it, that has changed so drastically and rapidly.
Would you say that's a change for the better?
I think the technological side is always, once it's embraced, I think it's good, you know, because it makes music more accessible. From a business side of it, it depends. You know, it really depends. I think when I started, it was still record companies. It was still, I mean, that's the only way you could get your music recorded was you, no one did, recorded their music on their own, right? So you needed to be signed to a record label, no matter how small or large. And then the record label got your music out there. And then this was the time of radio. And it's so neat that I'm doing this on radio. That's so cool.
I think it still is the time of radio.
Yeah. But radio, it was so driven by that, you know, commercial music.
And I think that's something that, you know, a lot of musicians feel, especially here locally, feel like they kind of have to go to the mainland. And we see this big brain drain, this talent drain from Hawaii. You know, a lot of people go to LA or Seattle or Portland to kind of really start, try to make it.
Absolutely.
What was it like for you? I mean, did you feel the same way kind of coming up as a jazz artist?
You know, it's something that I always thought about. What happened was I started playing with probably the greatest jazz musician from Hawaii ever, and it's Gabe Baltazar. So this happened in high school. So I graduate, and then I'm playing with Gabe, and I'm going to school, too, at the University of Hawaii, pursuing a music degree. So it seemed fine to me. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, I didn't think about it. I thought about it, and I had friends that did it. And they've done really great. In some ways, I've had opportunities that, say, for instance, if I had moved to New York City or Los Angeles, I probably wouldn't have those opportunities. So it's kind of like the big fish, small pond, or whatever, small fish, small pond thing. I'm not really equating it totally with ability, but it's just, you know, if you're there and you grew up there, mm-hmm. It's like I grew up here. There's a natural connection to the community, you know. So I've had incredible opportunities being here, playing with jazz musicians that I never thought I'd had the chance to play with. And that's been really gratifying.
And you've done a lot for the local community here. I mean, talking about, you know, fish and ponds, you've really created this fish pond here by, you know, advocating for the genre a lot. And notably, you have your monthly Ohana Jazz, which yes. I think is such a wonderful way to bring the community together,
yes.
especially a lot of local musicians, to celebrate jazz here mm-hmm. locally once a month.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Okay, that I really have to give credit where credit is due. And my wife, Leanne, it was in 2022, so we're sort of recovering from the pandemic. Mm. And prior to that, whatever was available as far as venues to play at were gone now. You know, very questionable whether they would start up again, and most of them didn't. So there weren't any venues for a jazz musician to play at. But anyway, my wife in 2022, we were talking, and she said, you know, you should approach the Musicians Union mm-hmm. to see if we could use Studio 909 as a venue. So through the help of Robert Shinoda, who's a great guitarist and musician, but also our secretary treasurer, and then our president, Jim Moffitt, who's a clarinetist with the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, they were very open, and the board of directors, they were very open to amending some of the rules to make it more accessible for members to utilize 909. So that was a big thing. We had a venue. We had somewhere we could stage this, you know, monthly gig. And then the other thing, my wife, because I was teaching at the time, I started teaching with the Hawaii Symphony Jazz Program that's directed by Dean Taba. And for the first time in my life, I'm an educator. You know, I taught private lessons here and there, you know, not commercially where I did it for a long period of time. And it's always been gratifying, you know, sharing and working with younger musicians. And I loved it. I loved being around young people. So my wife said, we should make it accessible for students. So that's why we only charge $10 to get in, just so that we can cover the cost of renting the room. And the other thing is we allow them to come and sit in with us, to come up and play with professional musicians. So it's great because they sit there and they hear us play. And then if they want to, they can come up and join us, you know. And it's every performance for 3.5 years we've had students come up and sit in. So that's been really fun.
And that's such invaluable experience, I think, as a musician, right? Just having the chance to perform, but in a way where you feel comfortable performing. I think that can be a big barrier for a lot of people.
Right. It's like, very friendly. It's a friendly environment. It's not intimidating at all.
Is that why it's called the Ohana Jazz?
Well, Ohana Jazz sort of came from my first solo project, which is titled Ohana. Mm-hmm. So we just kind of use that. But it does fit into what my wife wanted it to be, very family friendly. She wanted anyone to be able to feel comfortable there. And it's really turned into that.
Do you teach like your dad? Do you make him cry?
Oh, no, no. I don't actually. I'm actually pretty nice.
That's a good thing.
I don't know why, but...
We've talked a lot about what's drawn you to jazz, what draws your students to jazz. And, you know, whether it's that spark of the improv or just the sound of it itself, I mean, what is it that you really do love about jazz music?
Well, for me, it's the communal aspect of it. And I think that goes for any type of ensemble music. You have to enjoy playing with your colleagues, playing with your classmates or fellow musicians. And jazz is sort of at a different level because you're improvising, you know. So there's a high level of trust where you know that you're not thinking about, oh, what are they going to do? You just trust they're going to, you know, they're going to play something. And it's the fun part is like participating in that. Nothing is really planned. You know, you have to be prepared that once we play it, it may not even go the way we would just rehearsed it. And that's the beauty of the music. I love that aspect of it. Like, it's that kind of decision-making that's so much fun. You know, Dean Taba is a bass player, and then immediately when something happens, like, split second, we're, like, looking at each other. And then it's like, we're not, you know, it's not like, what are we going to do? You know, it's just, we just do something. You react to what happened. And as a result of that, it creates a reaction. Just, and maybe even the person that maybe went somewhere else, you know, they may come back or they may not. But we just...
That's improv.
Yeah,
that's,
it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Really beautiful.
That was HPR's Kevin Allen speaking with drummer and composer Noel Okimoto. Find out more about Ohana Jazz Night by heading to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That wraps it up for today. Tomorrow we hear from the City on Rail. It's a rocky road ahead as construction for Skyline looks beyond the urban core. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.